You're listening to There Ought to Be a Law, the Center for Auto Safety podcast with Executive Director Michael Brooks, Chief Engineer Fred Perkins, and hosted by me, Anthony Simino. For over 50 years, the Center for Auto Safety has worked to make cars safer. Hey, listeners, welcome to your favorite podcast.
Good morning, world.
People are thinking about this. They're like, wait, this isn't All Things Considered. I don't know if that's a podcast or not. But listeners, hey, I want to point out something to you. We love our passionate listeners and whatnot. If you're here, you probably agree with at least 85% of what we say. People have pointed out times when we're wrong and we go, oh, you know what? Maybe you're right. I want to point out that 90% of what comes out of my face is generally nonsense. And it's generally humor, and sometimes that's tough to translate. So, you know, just relax. I understand this is tough times, people adjusting to the new world order. You know, hopefully we're informative and a little entertaining. Sound good?
Sounds good to me.
I admire your confidence that you think you're actually funny.
I hate this show. This is my
idea. Sorry, I had to start in on you so quick.
I get it. All right. Stretch. Let's do a little story that came out in, I believe, today's or yesterday's New York Times about Rivian is teaming up with Volkswagen. So Volkswagen, you know, everyone's heard of it, older auto manufacturer, and they've been saying, hey, how do we get into this EV market? How do we get into this hardware and software stuff? And then they come across Rivian, which is run by a very smart, very clever engineer and a bunch of very smart, clever engineers. And they're like, hey, we're building this stuff, but how do we get money to do it? Because this stuff is expensive. So this is kind of neat where, you know, Volkswagen saying, hey, we used to have the mindset of that if we didn't invent it, it's not good enough. And then they're realizing, hey, maybe we should go to these Rivian folks. And I'll just put this as an aside. When I once worked for a fruit company, they also had the same belief that, hey, if we don't invent this software or hardware, it's garbage. Then they decided, hey, we can just buy everybody's idea. And that's turned out pretty well for them. So what would you guys take on this?
You know the company, the term synergy, what that means? Synergy is like 1 + 1 = 3, right? So this is basically a synergistic combination of two companies that are losing money that are somehow supposed to end up with a company that makes money. So it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out.
Are you familiar with the term cynicism?
No. What does that mean?
I don't know.
That's a Greek allusion, right? Something about Pericles? I'm not sure.
Shadows on a cave wall? I'm not sure either.
But we digress.
Yes.
Anyway. Yeah, I mean, it makes sense. I mean, Volkswagen is struggling recently for market share and struggling to get electric vehicles built and on the road. And Rivian has a lot more expertise in that area. So we'll see what happens here.
It's going to be interesting. All right. Now we start off with something sweet and light and easy. And now let's get right into it. Okay. Tesla and NHTSA. NHTSA, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, which we have a death watch on. No, that's just me. It's just me, really. They're kind of calling out Tesla saying, hey, you know, you guys keep saying your cars drive themselves. Well, they can't. And NHTSA is asking the company to revisit its communications to make sure messages are consistent with user instructions. And now that phrase, revisit its communications, in my mind, I just imagine NHTSA being this guy like wearing socks and sandals and being like, okay, hey, class, can we, like, you know, if we all just like just mellow out, like just revisit that. Is this, Michael, you have a lot of experience with NHTSA. Am I being cynical?
Well, I mean, so basically what happened was NHTSA's conducting this investigation of Tesla full self-driving, but they sent out a request, which they typically do in any investigation, you know, soon after opening, they'll send out a request, basically the manufacturer saying, here's everything we want from you. But in this one, they also attached an email from May, where they were speaking with Tesla about this issue, and particularly about Tesla's social media messaging. So Tesla came in April, apparently, of this year and briefed NHTSA and the Office of Defects Investigation, you know, and said, look, our owner's manual, our user interface, our YouTube messaging to drivers is that the vehicle's not autonomous. They have to pay attention, keep their hands and ready to go. But the agency pointed out, you know, in the month since they had that meeting with Tesla, from April to May, that they've come across, what, 10, a dozen Twitter posts from Tesla where they are actively supporting unsafe uses of the system, people that are not paying attention, not keeping their hands on the steering wheel, all of these other things that we've discussed ad nauseum previously. So they're catching Tesla in kind of a lie, or essentially Tesla's talking out of both sides of its mouth. On the one hand, they're saying, you know, we're putting out this messaging to people in our owner's manual and online that tells them they have to pay attention. Meanwhile, they're supporting tweets, reposting tweets online that do the opposite. So it looks like that's going to make up, you know, at least a portion of this investigation, looking into how Tesla is marketing or characterizing this technology in social media, which, as we know, has an outsized impact on human behavior as well. So it's an interesting take. I wish that this was, you know, a different situation. I'm not sure what is going to happen to this investigation now that Elon is being nominated to the non-existent Department of Government Efficiency.
So the head of the Department of Transportation, that's a political appointee. The president puts that person. Now, is the head of NHTSA also a political appointee?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So there's going to be a new head of NHTSA coming in January, right?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, we've seen so many acting administrators at NHTSA at this point that that's almost the norm. I think we've had one confirmed administrator in the past 7 or 8 years, maybe, that was, past 6 years now, I think, that was actually confirmed by the Senate. So it's you know, I who knows? There's probably an easier route to confirmation of folks this time, since the Senate appears to be, or the Senate is in Republican hands. So any nominees coming out of the Trump administration should probably not have too many problems getting past the Senate. So I don't know what the plan is for Musk's role in the administration, and how much the Trump administration is going to be paying attention to his particular beliefs on vehicles versus the government efficiency question, whatever all that means. But it's certainly troubling nonetheless.
So using my example of NHTSA being a guy wearing socks and sandals and probably a skullet and being like, hey, huh? So I imagine with this new administration, he's going to be that same guy, but with an atomic wedgie and just stuffed in a locker. Is that what we're seeing?
It's hard. It's always hard to predict, especially what we've seen of Trump administrations, what's going to happen. In this case, I mean, I'm expecting very industry friendly nominees to positions at the Department of Transportation and at NHTSA. And perhaps people that have absolutely no experience in the areas of transportation, which we saw during the last Trump administration.
Oh, boy. Well, what you're talking about here of Elon being in charge of Dogecoin at the White House, the Department of Government Efficiency, Washington Post has an article talking about this, saying it will be directed to drive drastic change by making recommendations on large scale structural reform and taking a more entrepreneurial approach to government. I have so many problems with that. Mainly entrepreneurial approach to government, because government isn't a business. It's not a business. It's most effective when it's inefficient.
Yeah, and how many startups fail for everyone that succeeds? Is that really how you want your government to run? It's a very risky proposition.
Yeah. So it's interesting, a little, just the next paragraph, it talks about how Trump is getting given to July 4th, 2026 for this group to finish its work and come up with some recommendations. And it's similar to the Grace Commission that Reagan appointed. And the Grace Commission submitted more than 2,500 recommendations to the White House and Congress in January 1984, most of which were never adopted. So, hey, on the plus side, these guys are going to make a bunch of noise. And if history is any clue, nothing will happen.
Well, I wouldn't be so quick to assume that. I mean, the Reagan administration had a devastating effect on NHTSA's funding. In fact, I would say that the agency has never recovered from that period of deregulation. So, you know, it's funny, and you know, we laugh because, you know, Elon and Trump are both easy to make fun of for their actions and their behaviors, but ultimately, you know, they may be putting into place systems that are going to result in far less oversight by NHTSA, by the Department of Transportation, and by other government agencies that we're engaged with.
I haven't been reading the newspapers for the last week, so I don't really know what you guys are talking about.
Welcome to Fred's meditation practice. It's the only way, the only guaranteed life extending service available. And further in the article, Elon says he wants to cut the number of federal agencies from over 400 to no more than 99, which is one of these things that sounds great on paper, but it's just nonsense. It's just words. I'm going to cut things and not say anything. But what you're talking about is the devastating effect on NHTSA and whatnot. Is that's why there's an organization such as the Center for Auto Safety, so we can be that annoying mosquito buzzing around these people's heads that they can't ignore as we continue to try and make roads safer for everybody. Go to autosafety.org and click on donate, please. Coming up next, we have we'll go slightly happy again. GM, I know you're thinking GM, always slightly happy. Well, GM is working on a bicycle alert system for most of its vehicles. Not all of them, but most of them. Basically, we've talked about this a lot with ADAS systems where automatic emergency braking, where it has a tough time identifying people at night, people of color, people on bicycles, children. So GM has kind of done a little PR spin about this and saying, hey, one of my friends was killed on a bicycle, and that's horrible. And they're saying this is why it's important to us to get this technology out there. But is this more just PR fluff? Is this a silent golf clap to GM saying, hey, thanks for doing the obvious?
I mean, what GM is announcing is that there are three technologies that are involved here. There is the front pedestrian detection, which is essentially cyclists in front of the vehicle and pedestrians as well. That's something that is being mandated by NHTSA to go into effect in 2029. All manufacturers are going to have that standard in their vehicles. So then they're saying they're going to get that into vehicles by 2025, I think, into all their vehicle standard, which is great. I'll be interested to see if they do that and if those systems meet the new NHTSA standard, which goes into effect in a few years. But in addition to that, which I think most vehicles are going to be have, they're doing side bicycle detection. So essentially, that's a lot like blind spot detection. You're driving along the road, and instead of just detecting vehicles that might be in your blind spot, their systems are going to be detecting folks on bicycles, which is also great. I mean, I'm sure we all love to be aware when anything is in our on the side of our vehicle that could be hit, and bicyclists are a lot harder to see in our rear view mirrors. So that's a great system. And also the situation where you've just parked your car on the road and you're getting out of your vehicle and you open your door right into the path of a bicyclist. Fred, has that ever happened to you?
I've never been doored. I've seen doors open and I've been able to avoid them so far, but I certainly know about that happening and people being injured by that.
Yeah, apparently it's a very common way that bicyclists are injured. So GM is wrapping, you know, all three of those into a package that they're putting onto their vehicles starting next year. It looks like all their vehicles standard without the government forcing them to. So that's good. There are a number of other manufacturers that have started to put this technology into their vehicles. They're just not doing it across their lines. Volvo and Mercedes, Hyundai, Kia, Toyota, Volkswagen, and some others have already started working on this. And this is coming into play. I think this is coming into play mainly because we've seen such a giant rise in pedestrian fatalities, and there's a renewed focus on that by the manufacturers, because, you know, frankly, the situation with pedestrians has gotten out of control. The numbers are grim, and without some better technology on vehicles to detect pedestrians and bicyclists, it doesn't show any signs of slowing up.
Yeah, and let's also recognize that this technology requires a lot of sensor fusion, new software, new applications. So there's radars looking out the side of the vehicle to implement this. There are cameras looking out the front and back. There is coupling with a brake system for automatic emergency braking. So there's a lot of complexity involved in this. I think that, you know, we need to give credit for work that's been done while still acknowledging that there is more work that could be done. But, you know, this is overall a really good thing that the manufacturers, the giant manufacturer like GM, is focusing on this and is implementing this. And hopefully the rest of the industry will come along and do similar safety projects. We've been advocating for this, that people take the technology being developed for AVs and apply it to existing vehicles and existing traffic situations. And I think this is one such example where that is... AV technology development is spilling over into what I think is a lot more practical and an immediate need for protecting people with existing vehicles and current technology.
The anti-doring stuff you mentioned, is that required in 2029?
No.
Okay.
No, the AEB rule only applied to automatic emergency braking to avoid pedestrians in front of the vehicle, and it did not include bicyclists as part of that. And I think that was because the manufacturers objected, because bicyclists are moving at higher speeds and are harder for their current technology to detect. That's what they claimed. I'm not sure how exactly true that is, but they're obviously higher speeds.
But they're detecting a vehicle that's moving at high speeds. I imagine.
Well, the vehicle is directly in front of them and is large and is not moving laterally. I think that's mainly the issue there.
Well, we've talked about perception in the past and how difficult perception is as a very complex cognitive function that the computer has got to undertake and has got to, you know, do a very good job if it's going to actually operate safely on streets automatically. And I think that this whole problem of perception of a bicycle is something that's difficult. If it were easy, they'd already be doing it. But the perception problem is difficult on a bicycle. It's not really large. It's bobbing around. It's moving at different speeds. So again, giving credit where due, I think that it's a really good thing that's happening. And hopefully there'll be more of that.
So, Michael, you said with bicycles, they're not moving laterally. Does the AEB rule apply to cross traffic, like at an intersection? So
no. If you can detect a pedestrian, we're going to see how well it works on the pedestrian detection side. We're still not 100% sure, you know, that it's not going to be perfect.
But I'm even thinking just a vehicle going cross traffic. So like I'm at an intersection, I'm going through. It's not.
The systems are designed to prevent rear collisions, so one vehicle hitting another one from behind. So they're not equipped to capture, a speeding vehicle that runs a red light in front of you. I don't think they're going to be. They might capture it close to the end near impact, but they're not going to be designed to have, you know, a 360-degree view of the roads all around you and to detect vehicles coming down the street laterally. That's more in the realm of what, you know, vehicle-to-vehicle communications or vehicle-to-infrastructure communication could accomplish for safety, but automatic emergency braking is not there yet.
Okay, well, good to know. Check your mirrors before opening your doors and don't hit a bicyclists. Because I know in New York State, well, I don't know if this is true anymore, but it used to be that, yeah, if you hit like a motorcyclist, they hit in your door, they were at fault. But, you know, then you're, you don't have a door and you're dealing with someone who's got a life-threatening injury probably. So, hey, check your mirrors, right? Everyone agrees.
Yeah, hey. Did you ever hear it was called the Dutch Reach or something?
Yeah, where, I was just thinking of that. Yeah.
Yeah, in other country, I think in Holland, or the Netherlands, whatever they're calling it these days, they teach drivers in driver's education to reach for the door handle with their right arm. So they're reaching over, which forces them to look at least towards their rearview mirror as they're exiting the vehicle so that they have an opportunity to see any bicyclists or pedestrians approaching before they open their door. That seems to be a kind of a no-nonsense solution if we could, if we didn't have to rely on the technology, but fortunately, maybe we'll have the technology there to help us as well.
I love it. The Dutch Reach. Okay. That's something new we will learn today, or at least I've learned today. We've talked about this a lot before. No one likes touchscreen so much. Not big fans of the touchscreen. We all miss our buttons. And Hyundai has said, hey, we did some user surveys, some things like that. And it turns out people hate it when they have to click through multiple screens just to adjust their air conditioning. And it's fascinating because there's an article from InsideEVs.com, and they basically say the quiet part out loud is every manufacturer saw Tesla's gee whiz factor with a touchscreen and said, hey, we got to be gee whiz too. Let's do this. Because it looks awesome in a demo. I blame Steve Jobs when he released the dock function of the Mac OS. I remember being at this event and he's like, look how cool this thing looks. And we're all like, this is such a stupid idea. This is bad usability. But Steve thought it was pretty and he got to scroll and it looked awesome on TV. And hey, it looks like something out of the future and some Hollywood movie. And that's what all the manufacturers did with touchscreens. They're like, hey, remember when you used to push a button? Now, hey, how about clicking through 8 different screens with no tactile feedback? And so thankfully, Hyundai is saying, you know, maybe we should put some buttons back in. I applaud this.
Yeah, I mean, they're putting buttons back in for a number of reasons now. There's a pretty sound consumer rejection of putting everything into the touchscreen system, particularly things that you want to access quickly while you're driving. I mean, we've spoken a number of occasions about how we don't want any safety features being hidden in a menu behind a touchscreen. I mean, there are things that have to be accessed immediately, like wipers and headlights and other features where buttons make all the sense in the world, especially buttons that are put in a place that is recognizable from car to car to car so that people don't have to relearn their locations every time they're in a different vehicle. Some things may be okay behind a touchscreen. I mean, if you want to do a deep dive into your fuel economy or into your trip distances and that type of thing, that's great. You can do that when you're parked at home, but there's a lot of features that just simply don't belong under a touchscreen menu. I mean, air conditioning is certainly arguably one. If you're driving, you want to make a quick adjustment to the climate in the vehicle without losing sight of the road. It's sometimes I think it's much easier to do so through a button versus or a dial versus navigating a touchscreen menu.
Agreed. Fred?
I think my car has got a pretty good mix of buttons and touchscreen. I like the way they've done that. And in fact, they just came out with an update to the software that put a lot of those functions back onto the front screen as well as alongside the buttons. So that's my Subaru, my 2020 Subaru. I like the way they've done that. They've got the temperature disposed in buttons, and they've got the climate control mode, like whether or not you're going to have defrost or warm your feet or whatever. That's on the touch screen. And if you want to go into deeper considerations, and you can go down to different levels on the touchscreen, but they've done a good job. So I don't think it's all one or the other. There's got to be some optimum mix.
I don't know. My touchscreen, I have no idea what the functions are. I just let my phone take it over because anytime I click on a button on the default Toyota stuff, it's like, oh, you don't have this service. Oh, you don't have this service. Oh, you don't have this service. So I just plug my phone in and say, hey, car, play this song. And then it just plays that song on repeat forever, over and over. Or it does variations of that song from children's choirs to orchestras to heavy metal interpretations. And it drives me
Oh,
nuts. It's annoying. It's awful. But hey, that gets us into Gaslight this week. Everybody ready for some Gaslight fun? Everybody, come on. Mr. Perkins, kick us off. I know
wow.
you're excited.
Excuse me.
Whoa, that excited.
My bad. Sorry. So I have identified my Gaslight nominee this week as Motional, which is a company in Massachusetts, that is teamed with Hyundai to produce autonomous vehicles. And it's really kind of like a throwback to where we were a year ago with these things before the infamous incident in San Francisco, because Motional's homepage says, quoting from that, "Our vehicles are never drowsy, drunk, or distracted. They're expert drivers, singularly focused on the task at hand, safely traveling from point A to point B." Well, that's interesting. They never identify where points A and B are, so we don't really know what the universe of safe operations for these vehicles is. That'd be useful to know. But, inquiring minds would like to know really where the boundaries of Motional AV safety are. But it's important in thinking about this to see the sleight of hand, because the statement really asks the listener to project their own driving capabilities onto the vehicle when they say that they're expert drivers. And they really wanted to presume that they're somehow better because they're never drowsy, drunk, or distracted. So really, it's an interesting sleight of hand that everybody who addresses this in this way is using. But they never provide an affirmative statement of capabilities. So they're really just asking you to project your own capabilities into the void and, put aspirational properties that they hope to be present. It's kind of like defining the atmosphere as the absence of a vacuum. The absence of data is not data, and the atmosphere is a lot more than the absence of a vacuum. Absence of a vacuum is one property they've got, in the same way that this statement about their vehicles being safe really is just about a void into which you're projecting yourself. And let's be real, some of the things it does not have is certification that it understands the rules of the road, like anybody who's got a learner's permit. Doesn't have certification that it's a competent driver, like anybody who's got a driver's license. And importantly, there's no evidence that it ever cares whether or not it's driving safely or whether it cares about the safety of the universe around it. So it goes on. But I'm going to skip to the end of my rant here because, in the interest of time. And what they say, though, as you get into it, is that they've filed a voluntary safety self-assessment, which is something that you can find on the NHTSA website. And in that, they say that their quantitative assessment centers around mileage accumulation on public roads to demonstrate statistically that unknown hazardous scenarios are sufficiently rare. Well, they never say what sufficiently rare is. They never talk about how they demonstrate statistically that they're compliant with their standards or what those standards are. And instead, they refer to subsection 1223 of the VSSA. And if you dive into that, it says confidence in our capabilities and known scenarios is only meaningful in conjunction with an understanding of the frequency of unknown scenarios in the ODD of the AAV. Statistical safety testing accumulates mileage to establish whether the occurrence of unknown hazardous scenarios lies below an acceptable threshold. And then both the operational definition of unknown hazardous scenarios and the appropriate threshold remain areas of active discussion within the industry and society. What they're basically saying is they don't know what the hell they're talking about. They've got no basis, no statistical or numerical basis for saying what safety is, but that's okay because it's still under discussion. So what is their underlying their assertion that this is about safe operation? It's really astonishingly vapid. So skipping right to the end here, they say, until the completion of safety validation and sign off on safety, we operate with a trained safety driver when testing AVs on public roads. Well, that's good. And then it considers the functional safety of the AV system and evaluates whether scenario-based testing and statistical safety testing adequately demonstrate the absence of unreasonable risk. So again, absence of unreasonable risk is not a design standard. It's a legal concept that just says there's no basis for suing us, right? A design standard is not a void. You can't say, I'm going to design to nothing. You have to design to something. And so this is very important. We need to move away from this whole idea that absence of unreasonable risk within this industry, which is what they all use, is a reasonable approach. Their partners in this nonsense include Hyundai, Lyft, Uber, Uber Eats, Via, the AVSC, and AVIA. But they don't focus on affirmative safe operation, and none of them do. And also a gentle reminder here that using Uber Eats seems to indemnify Uber against damages if you're subsequently injured while using Uber rideshare services, which is another interesting side effect to this. So for all that, but basically Motional's statement that their safety claims are based on nothing at all, I have nominated them for my Gaslight of the Week award.
Excellent. I have some follow-up questions for you there, Fred. So Motional says that they're safer than a human, right?
They don't say that. They imply it. They ask.
Okay.
They really, through clever word, and they ask you to infer that.
Okay, so they imply they're safer than a human. But hey, we're keeping a human behind the wheel, you know, just in case. So they've got a human that's better than their software behind the wheel, because if not, what's the point of having a human there at all? But stepping back from that, even they do the classic trifecta of we will never drive drunk, drowsy, or distracted. Okay, I can give them 100%, all of these companies, that no computer will ever be drunk, without a doubt. I think we can all agree on that. Drowsy? Drowsy is you're falling asleep, you're losing attention. Everyone who's ever used a computer knows they'll get drowsy. They will definitely, especially over time, your computer slows down. It doesn't get faster over time. It gets less reliable over time because, you know, entropy. Distracted? Come on. Every computer's everyone who's ever seen that spinning beach ball or that hourglass thing that just freezes in front of your face, those computers get distracted. I don't know what the hell they're doing behind there. It doesn't know what's doing behind there. It's just like, hey, this application's stuck. So don't, you know, you can have your drunk, but you're drowsy and distracted. That is not just a human quality, okay? I'm sorry.
No argument. Yeah, but I want to explore drunk a little bit. What does it mean to be a drunk driver? Well, it means that your reactions are slow and you're making decisions that are less than rational, right? I mean, those are the problems with drunk driving, because if you were making rational decisions and you had normal reactions, you wouldn't say you were drunk. So The question arises, does a computer ever act as though it is drunk? Does it ever make irrational decisions? Well, we all know AI examples that are really kind of crazy. So we've that happens.
The Waymo and, going down the other side of the street. Yeah.
Yeah. Little things like that, and zigzagging when they're traveling behind a trailer and certainly acting drunk. And we also know of a lot of situations where the computers have very slow reactions. In fact, if you've ever used a computer, you've probably experienced the computers locking up or applications within the computer just failing to respond. So even though they're not drunk chemically, they certainly can act drunk or with equivalent behavior. So yeah, anyway, But going back to the original, they ask you to project your own capabilities into this and say, it's just like you, except better, without ever clearly stating it. So
I love it. I want to be just like me, but better too. All right, Mr. Brooks, what's your gaslight of the week?
Mine is pretty simple, going back to a story we discussed earlier, which is a classic example of gaslighting. In this case, it wasn't necessarily the public that was being gaslighted, which is normally the subject of our gaslights, but it was NHTSA with Tesla coming into the NHTSA office or briefing them online. I'm not sure how that happened, but basically a meeting was between Tesla and NHTSA's investigative staff, and Tesla says, look, we're doing all this to make sure that drivers are paying attention to their vehicles while they're in full self-driving mode. We have messages in our owner's manual. We've got messages in the user interface and the vehicle. And we have messaging online on YouTube to drivers that the vehicle is not autonomous and that the driver must remain in full control all the time. Meanwhile, you know, Tesla on the side is going online and supporting posts on Twitter that say the exact opposite, that highlight really poor uses of the technology, that, you know, drivers are saying, look, I can take my hands off the wheel and sit back and have a little rest and not get fatigued. And Tesla's supporting that type of behavior on Twitter. So that's a classic example of gaslighting. And I think it fits great as my gaslight of the week.
Excellent. My gaslight of the week is related to a story we just discussed too. I was so afraid Michael's going to steal mine, but it's Elon Musk, gaslighter of the century, from that Washington Post article where he's talking about making government more efficient. Elon also says he wants to see federal spending cut by $2 trillion. Keep in mind, this is a guy whose entire companies are based off of, you know, dining on the government teat. You know, Tesla made what, $800 million from selling carbon credits, which is just like selling baseball cards. Bullshit.
Yeah, I can assure you that will not be cut for the budget.
That will not be cut. No, SpaceX gets how much money for launching satellites and stuff out of NASA's pile? Yeah, that
we're not cutting that.
That's not getting cut. No way. What will get cut is a bunch of things he doesn't like, hey, stop calling BS on my lies, like the around. So the SEC, yeah, that'll be cut because they I don't like them. NHTSA, yeah, that's gonna get cut. For the EPA, yeah, because you know I can't just dump rocket fuel wherever the hell I want. But that's not gonna add up anywhere close to $2 trillion. So
wait, come on now. I'm sure that these people are gonna be very aware of conflicts of interest. And we all know that there were no conflicts of interest in the last Trump administration. So, you know, we can expect that same high quality of ethical behavior in the upcoming administration.
I would like to change my gaslighter of the week to Fred Perkins. Gaslighter.
Wait, who's being cynical now, Anthony?
I'm not sure what that word means still. Okay, let's go on. Thinking of cynical, California Public Utilities Commission. My favorite of the public utility commissions. An article in Reuters, we have a link in MSN.com, titled California Agency Boosts Reporting Requirements for Autonomous Vehicle Incidents. That's great. California State Agency said on Thursday it is mandating enhanced data reporting requirements for autonomous vehicles, including reports for incidents where self-driving cars get stuck. Thank God. I can't believe that. Like when they drive into wet cement, when they have their existential crisis in the middle of intersection, that wasn't included in their reporting. So I am all for this. Please tell me why I'm wrong.
No, you're right. End of show.
We're done. I am right.
That's a big bullet point. There are basically three main areas where they're going to be beefing up reporting in California on AVs. That's the kind of the number one highlighted one. It's stoppage events is what they're calling it. So all the AV operators have to report any incident where the AVs get stuck or, you know, have a breakdown, or I think we described it as a some type of crisis of movement at some point. I can't remember exactly, but That's one thing. Those stoppage events where we saw, you know, buses, fire trucks, emergency responders of other sorts get trapped on roads behind a vehicle that was stopped in the middle of the road having an identity crisis. Those are going to be reported to the California Public Utilities Commission now. Also, they are enhancing their incident reporting. So everyone operating AV has to report on both collision and non-collision incidents, including, you know, traffic tickets and other things. So
do they get traffic tickets? Like, that's
apparently, but I don't know. They have to report them. It says including citations and stoppage events. So.
See, that's the thing I was confused about, because they said like including citations, but like, who is citing them? And I thought California exempted these guys from basically all traffic laws.
No, I don't think so. No.
Oh, okay.
I think they could still get tickets. I mean, if you're blocking a road, for instance, maybe a citation is, you know, a parking ticket because they parked in a no stop zone. Who knows?
Well, I think what's happening is that these tickets are not being issued to the individual vehicles. The citations are being given to the company as kind of an advisory. So it's not the sort of thing where they're going to fine the individual vehicle $20 for a violation. They're just sending a note back to the manufacturer saying, you know, please be aware that your vehicle did something bad. I think that's what's happening.
But do we actually know if that's actually happening now? Because that seemed to be, because I remember we had the sheriff on a couple of years ago. He's like, I don't know who we'd ticket. And I spoke to a former NYPD officer and he said, yeah. He's like, who would we give a ticket to? He's like, there's no way we're going to the GM's office being like, here you go, here's a $150 parking ticket.
I can't cite the reference, but I think I read somewhere there is a mechanism for feeding back that violation information to the manufacturer. But I'm sorry, I don't have the details.
And in some cases, I mean, most of these vehicles that are on the road now, at least, have a safety driver in them, and I'm presuming that the safety driver is going to be the recipient of the citation.
Well, not Waymo's. They got no safety drivers.
No.
So So listeners, if you guys know this, ideally somebody who used to, you know, who's upset, who used to work for Waymo or Cruise, you know, who wants to like blow a little whistle. Like, no, you don't even have to blow a whistle. Just tell us no. There's no parking tickets, or yes, we have a stack of unpaid parking tickets. Because I think, and listeners, correct me if I'm wrong, but this has always been the thing where I'm like, who's getting this? So anyway, I'm sorry, Michael, I was interrupting you.
No, there's only one more area. They're up there. They've got the stoppage event reporting, enhanced incident reporting, and also they're calling streamlined collision reporting. So AV operators are going to have to report all collisions, both to CPS, CPUC, the Public Utilities Commission, and NHTSA within one day of a collision. So that gives them, you know, quicker access to information about collisions, and allows them to, you know, respond more quickly when those collisions have taken place to gather more knowledge before it disappears.
All right. So ideally a step in the right direction. And if you donate, we'll find out if they're actually giving tickets to these companies. That's right. That's the only way we're going to do work is by soliciting donations. No, that's not true. We'll try and hunt this information down. But for now, it's time to enter the world of Mr. Fred.
You've
Perkins,
now entered the Tao of
town,
Fred.
Fred, and he's going to talk to us about duty of care.
Thank you, Anthony. Thank you for that introduction. So this week, it's a little bit complicated, but I want you to try to hang on as we go through this. So there's a relationship between duty of care that we've talked about, and risk, and also hazard. But there are separate things. So as I understand it, and Michael slapped me upside the head if I got this wrong, that the rules of the road are really informed by the duty of care. Every driver assumes the mantle of duty of care when they operate their vehicle legally, and they're expressed in the rules of the road. So whether a driver's vehicle is safe enough to operate is consistent with the rules of the road. In other words, if you do everything right and you're within the rules of the road, the vehicle is safe enough from the perspective of the legal system. And the harm caused by violation of the rules of the road that involve the duty of care, they provide cause for law enforcement actions and judicial actions, including liability and damages. I think I got that right. Is that right? Yeah, Michael's nodding his head. But taking that a little bit further, those ideas provide a basis to consider the risk of harm. Now, risk is usually expressed as a two-parameter problem. So you've got both the consequence of the harm, right? Something's going to bang into something else. But you've also got the probability that the harm will be encountered. So it would be really bad to have a meteorite land on your car, but the probability of that happening is very low. So you're not going to worry about that, right? So risk mapping is a useful way, I should say, of managing resource allocation for prevention of harm. So that's, unfortunately, the approach that the AV company is using to design the safety of vehicles, reliance on risk. So that allows them to say that, well, these things are really unlikely to happen, so we don't have to care about it. How likely is it that you're going to run into a woman crossing a road in the middle of the night walking a bicycle? Oh, it's not likely to happen at all. Yet Ms. Hertzberg in Arizona unfortunately lost her life because that was not an anticipated event. So I think that the AV companies prefer to consider risks rather than hazards because it's a lot easier, and they can convince themselves that there are certain things they don't have to do. Now, there's a considerable basis of experience now on cars driving themselves. We have a lot of experience from Tesla, and we also have a lot of documentation associated with that, both in video form and reports that they've given to NHTSA, right, through the Standard General Order?
Standing
General Order. There are also a lot of events that have been documented by Waymo, a lot by Cruise. So when an operating AV encounters a hazard, risk isn't really important because the probability of it happening is 100%. Right? They're actually there encountering the hazard. So really what the vehicles should be doing is they should be designing for hazard mitigation in every event that they know of where a hazard can occur or has been demonstrated to occur, and then folding that into their risk evaluation, right? So the operational AV tactical decisions, when they're operating, they're all made on the basis of hazard evaluation, not risk. They see something happening, they respond to it. That's different than designing for risk, because when you design for risk, you can convince yourself that, well, that's really unlikely to happen, so I don't have to spend any resources to accommodate that. Right now, there's a long and unfortunately rapidly growing list of what demonstrated hazards are for AVs and also hazards that people anticipate reasonably could be happening. And my belief is that the AVs should be designed to avoid every one of the hazards that have been identified, and every one of the hazards that have been identified either conceptually based on the designer's engineering judgment or in practice based upon the experience of the AVs operating on the roads, right? This involves conflicts with pedestrians, cars going off the road. It involves AVs beeping at each other, stopping at intersections. So it seems to me that it's a very simple process to catalog all of these different hazard events and verify that every AV that's allowed on the road is shown to mitigate the hazard associated with these events rather than to worry about the risk, for example. And to be the equivalent of a human driver, the computer actually has to be able to feel the pucker factor that would a human being would feel if they saw, for example, a trail of infants walking across the street behind a daycare teacher, right, all tied together with a rope. you have a different human response to that than you would if you saw a string of adults crossing the road. So that pucker factor is something that would come out of a hazard mitigation focus rather than a risk mitigation focus, right? So regression right now in the industry is really regression associated with hazard mitigation is oriented towards what they call a minimal risk condition. Now, we've talked about this before. It does not confer safety, but it gives the AV developers coverage to say, well, I'm working towards a minimal risk condition. It's written right here in the regulations that I have to manage towards a minimal risk condition, and then everything is okay. That's really fundamentally wrong, because you don't want to manage risk in the AV industry so much as you want to manage the hazards that these AVs create, have encountered, and are associated with their operation. So this is a little bit of inside baseball, but I think it's very important, because what the AV designers should be oriented towards is designing for an affirmative acceptable safety operational standard, rather than designing towards a void that allows them to evade legal responsibility for whatever damage their vehicle may cause. Evading responsibility for damage is what a focus on a risk allows them to do. Designing for hazard mitigation and demonstrating that they can, in fact, evade all the hazards that are known is a much better approach towards safety, and allows them to, in fact, emulate what a human being would do in a similar situation when confronting that same hazard. So again, inside baseball, but I think, you know, for the industry to succeed, the hazard mitigation has got to be addressed first. And then the compliance with the duty of care and the rules of the road and the risk considerations should be last in this train of analysis associated with safe operation. Does that make sense? And it could be a little confusing, but I think that it's a little bit of a different approach than people have used in the past.
It's dense, but yeah. So are you talking about these hazards of, you're saying, okay, we can collect a list of these hazards, and would this be something you'd suggest for, hey, these AVs need to pass this as part of their driver certification, their AV driver's license?
Yeah, I think so. You know, for example, whatever has happened that has caused AVs to either kill or injure a human being, or to impact or cause property damage in their operations, should be cataloged. And the vehicles, before they're put on the street, before they're allowed to be put on the street, should have to demonstrate that they can evade these or mitigate these hazards in a test track with reasonable statistical confidence, right? I think that that's the minimum that should be done. I don't think that AV developers should be allowed to prevaricate and just say, well, it's not going to happen. It's unreasonable if this would happen twice. So, you know, we're just going to say that the risk is very low. Remember, risk has two parts: the probability of it happening and the consequence of the event, right? So as long as you're in a risk-dominated analysis of safety, you can always say that it's unlikely to happen. And this is where I think that NHTSA and state regulators should jump in and say, well, you may say it's unlikely, but, you know, this person is dead, or that event happened and this damage occurred. So you got to show on a test track, and you got to show in simulation, you got to show in every way possible or practical that this is not going to happen if we, the regulators, give you authority to operate this vehicle on the road, on the highway. When you're operating on the highway, you're not in a risk avoidance environment. You're in a hazard avoidance environment, because the probability of something happening when you see it is 100%, right? Because you've seen it. You've seen it developing. So I think that that this is very important for the regulators to consider. And before they give authority to developers to operate on the highway, They really need to show that everything known that can cause damage by AAVs has been accommodated in the safety design. This is not happening now. And people are still being allowed to put the vehicles on the highway by waving their hands and saying, it's really unlikely to happen. So well, how could it ever happen twice?
They won't be drunk, distracted, or drowsy. So
that's right.
Yeah. So, hey, state regulators, because I'm giving up on the federal level for a short period of time. State regulators, at least some states, pay attention to this because, if you're a state, say, one of those third world country states like California and New York, you can say, hey, wait a second. Let's not put this stuff on the road. Okay, not if you're California. If you're New York, you can come out and say, yeah, we're not putting this on the road because, I want to get reelected or I don't want to kill people. Take one of those two.
Yeah, I'd vote for Massachusetts, too, because I happen to live here.
Well, yeah, but that's some third world place up there, Massachusetts. Speaking of third world places, visit autosafety.org and click on donate. What? That was a weird transition. Why would he say such things?
Yeah, I don't even know if the use of the term third world is allowed anymore, Anthony. So you might be chastised for that.
Well, it wouldn't be the first time. I'm just quoting our dear leader. Anyway, let's time for some recalls. Let's
strap in. Time for the recall now.
First up, General Motors. Oh my God, 461,839 2021 Cadillac Escalade ESV, Chevy Silverados, and Chevy Suburbans and Chevy Tahoes and GM Sierras, and the list goes on and on and on. This is a transmission control valve, maybe susceptible to excessive wear over time, resulting in a gradual loss of pressure within the valve that can cause harsh shifting. In rare cases, the real worlds may experience a momentary lockup. Oh boy.
Yeah, this is actually, it notes in the submission by GM that this is yet another success coming out of the GM Speak Up for Safety program, which gives their engineers
a quick way to resign.
it gives them incentive to speak up about problems that they notice, whether they're on the line or even if it's reported by a customer. So that's a success. And it's a lot of vehicles. It looks like, it's going to be owners. It looks like a staggered notification system on this one. So it's a large recall. So they're probably not going to be able to fix everything at once.
They're doing it based off of what you paid. So the Escalade, they're getting noticed first, and then the Suburbans, they'll get notified last.
It may be that if you paid the most for a big Cadillac, you might be getting the first notice, but they're going to start notification December 9th. And the last phase of their owner notification is going to start around the end of February. So if you do own one of these vehicles, it may be 3 months before you hear from GM regarding the software update.
Excellent. Next one, Chrysler, 206,502 vehicles, the 2018 to 2019 Jeep Grand Cherokee, the Dodge Durangos. It is a hydraulic control unit / anti-lock brake system module. Uh-oh, brake light may come on when you haven't touched your brakes.
Well, this is also... This problem allows the vehicle to be shifted out of park without holding the brake pedal, which is the brake shift interlock system that vehicles are required to have in place to prevent vehicles from rolling away. So essentially, this is a rollaway problem. The vehicles, if this condition occurs, you can shift out of park without depressing the brake pedal. And so unintended vehicle movement can result from that. Vehicles can roll down driveways and other areas and parking lots and hurt people. So that is the, that's what's happening here. The remedy for this is still under development. So we may not see it. It looks to be a software issue because it's a HECU ABS module that's not reading pressure properly on the circuit. I'm assuming they're going to address this with a software fix of some kind, but they have not been able to come up with that yet. So it may be some time before owners of these vehicles are able to get a fix. And so we'd advise everyone who owns, I think it's the 28 2019 Grand Cherokee or Dodge Durango to be really careful with your shifting in and out of park for the next few months while you wait for that fix.
All right. Tesla up next. 2,431 vehicles, the 2024 Tesla Cybertruck. It turns out if you've bought this vehicle, they want you to return it and they want to slap you in the face because you're a silly, silly person. No, this is a drive inverter may cause it to stop producing torque. Whoa. Oh, it's one of their MOSFETs have failed. Really? MOSFETs are like, you can get them anywhere. They've been making them forever. Like, huh?
This really goes back to what you were talking about earlier with drunk computers, right? So computers are dependent upon the analog performance of the devices that support the computer calculations. And a MOSFET is basically a switch that turns electrical current off and on. So if the MOSFET fails, it's a, you know, in an analog way, meaning it just doesn't work anymore, then the inputs going to the computer are faulty and it's a lot like being drunk, right? It just doesn't get the information anymore that it can use to calculate responses properly.
I mean, MOSFETs, what, they first came out in the 60s? Is that right?
I'm not sure. They basically were developed to replace relays.
Yeah. I mean, you can buy like a thousand of them for like a dollar. I think they're now, okay, that's an exaggeration. I know someone's going to get very upset, be like, I make MOSFETs in my kitchen. They're very inexpensive is what I'm trying to say. They're very kind of a standard part. They're not.
Well, they are, but the ones that can handle the high current for electric propulsion tend to be more expensive, to be fair.
$2. I mean, they're not, it's not something where you're breaking the bank. It's not rocket science.
It is not rocket science. It's okay. Electrical engineering.
anyway, so Tesla, you're going to be noticed shortly on or after December 9th.
Yeah. And this is actually January 4th is when it looks like the owner notifications are going out. Mm-hmm. But they're going to... this is the sixth recall of the Cybertruck, and you're going to have to take your vehicle into the dealer for this one because it does require a physical repair. So there will be no over-the-air update for the Tesla owners on this one.
Oh, this is just a little aside for a Cybertruck owner. So a lot of people, you know, there's stainless steel and people think, well, they won't get stained and not how it works. Anyway, they've been putting these vinyl wraps on their cars, thinking that's going to protect it. Where a couple of people, they just said, hey, we're going to take the wraps off and really give a real clean down. And they take the wrap off and they go, ah, oh, my God, this is rusted. What's going on? Why is this stuff rusted? So if you're a Cybertruck owner, I'm sorry. I'm falling for all sorts of things.
A couple words about chemistry. The way the stainless steel works is it develops a coating of chromium oxide on the outside that is shields the rest of the structure from oxygen. Unfortunately, when you wrap it in plastic, you're prohibiting access to oxygen. And so when water gets in, it causes it to rust because the chromium oxide coating can never develop. So that's why new stainless steel is shinier than old stainless steel, because the old stainless steel has got that coating. And that's why you should never wrap the stainless steel in something that's going to prohibit invasion of oxygen, because that oxidation of the chromium is what protects it.
And to quote Frank Zappa, give me the chromium. Last up, BMW, 3,312 vehicles, the 2025 BMW. Why do they name their cars these stupid names? X1 xDrive 28i, X1 M35i. This is some sort of SUV vehicle. The supplier-produced B-pillar reinforcement plate is out of specifications. Uh-oh, and it may not have enough structural integrity to survive a crash. That's not good.
No, that's really bad. I mean, they're still developing a fix for this, so it doesn't look like this will be another one where owners are probably going to have to wait for some time. But this is concerning when your B-pillar reinforcement plate is not supported properly. It looks like they're that the problem was that the materials that were that came in that, that made up the B-pillar reinforcement plate were out of spec. So they essentially, I guess, the metal or whatever they used for the B-pillar support plate was not what they were expecting. They got a bad batch from their supplier, and so it makes the plates crack and fail. So that's something that owners should keep an eye out on, because you know it's a significant problem if you if you're in a crash where your B pillar is required to support the vehicle's occupant cabin.
And that's it for our show today, for your recalls, for our MOSFETs, for our Elon FETs, and for our Boba FETs, and babbling FETs. And yeah, I'm just gonna keep this is the outro music playing. Thank God. All right. Till next time. That's not the outro music at all. All right. Thanks, listeners. Till next time.
Bye. Thank you for listening.
For more information, visit www.autosafety.org.